So this is intended to be a general discussion, blackboard lunch. So people who are not in our program are encouraged to ask questions and make this more interactive. Some of the people in our program are the experts and may be bored, but I'll try to say a few things that are interesting to them as well. So what I want to talk about is the relationship of quantum field theory in general, and you'll see some specific cases, to hydrodynamics. Now, these two things sound very different, and indeed they are. Let's just list the main differences. This, of course, is intended to be microscopic, at least over a very wide range of timescales. And so short distances and short times. Whereas hydro is certainly only intended from the beginning to be valid at large distances and long time. But fundamentally, we should be describing the same physics, whether we look at it at very short scales or very long scales. And the whole issue, the whole point of this talk, is how one can go in a systematic way from the scales to those scales. You'll see what I mean exactly. Of course,
it looks short, looks long.
Well, I'm going to tell you. If you have a microscopic field theory, you have some intrinsic mass or time scales in the problem. If you think about it at high temperature, then the short distance or time scale is just set by the temperature, whereas one is interested in going to distances and times that are much longer than the inverse temperature. That's just one example, but it could be many others. Of course, we have in mind fundamental theories which have Hamiltonians and are therefore time reversible. Non-dissipated. But we want to describe physics at late times, which is non-Hamiltonian, and maybe in general quite time non-reversible, irreversible. So there is a very fundamental issue here, going back, you know, to the roots of statistical mechanics, Boltzmann, starting with time-reversible dynamics in, for example, molecular collisions, and determining the time, how time irreversibility arises effectively. So now we're going
to ask this clarification.
Yeah.
But hydrodynamics is kind of a special case of, let us say, transport
right.
processes.
Right.
So why do you pick out just hydrodynamics, or is that just the generic term for transport theory? Because it seems to me what you really want to do is do transport theory without necessarily assuming that you're making the hydrodynamic assumptions.
Okay, well, there are several stages to get from here to there.
Yeah.
One of them could be the kinetic approach, in which you don't go completely to the hydrodynamic limit. But let me go on, because all these issues will come up. You have, of course, in principle in the quantum theory, phase coherence when you start out, but by the end of the day, you have no phase coherence. So there's issues here about phase averaging and the loss of phase coherence, which are at the essential root of the classical transition. And also, we would like to be able to describe general initial states. Certainly, for heavy ion collisions and many other cases, one has to specify particular initial states, which are far from equilibrium, whereas later on, we have at least locally near thermal equilibrium states. That's the basic assumption of hydrodynamics, which lets you use an equation of state. Okay, so you see that this is non-trivial and it's not going to be easy. And there have been, of course, there's a long history of this kind of subject in classical statistical mechanics, starting with particular models like hard spheres and trying to get to fluid-like behavior at large distance and time scales. But my context today will be completely within the quantum field theory context. Now, the main message, which I'm going to try to convey today, is that this is possible for weakly coupled theories. In other words, when there is a weak coupling somewhere in the microscopic theory, then it's possible by resumming diagrams, essentially, and we'll talk about how, to go from this description to this description. And in particular, calculating, as you already mentioned, this is one particular application of these methods to calculate transport coefficients and explicitly show how hydrodynamic behavior comes out of the field theory, calculate transport coefficients in leading order in the coupling.
You're not saying it should be hydro doesn't hold strong coupling, but just...
No, it's just that we don't have good methods to make this connection precise.
Right.
I mean, no doubt it works generally. Okay. So the first thing you may ask yourself is, well, if you have the theory, if you have the microscopic theory, why don't you just solve it? What's the big deal here? Right? You have a Hamiltonian.
So.
You like that?
Or? Well,
the problem, of course, is that there are too many degrees of freedom. So you can do a little counting. If you take a simple idea like a scalar field, just classically, take a scalar field variable, which is a function of space and time. And if you wanted to solve the classical equations, which of course are deterministic partial differential equations in general, then you have to somehow discretize this. So the number of points is basically some box size, some infrared cutoff, divided by an ultraviolet cutoff, the lattice spacing, and that's the number in one dimension. In d dimensions, you'd have that many points. And so you have to discretize the system classically on this number of points and follow that many degrees of freedom, depending on the fineness of your grid. However, quantum mechanically, we have to solve not for a single field configuration, but for some kind of wave functional evaluated on the field configuration and time. Okay, so now you basically have to not only discretize the number of points, but at every point you have a variable phi which takes on some number of values, and you want to write down an amplitude for every one of those values. So basically you have to take a number of values of the phi field and multiply that by the volume. So that many functions of time have to be followed if you were going to solve this thing for a pure state wave function with a given Hamiltonian. So you can just put in some numbers. If this were only 10, that doesn't sound like a lot of grid points, 10, three dimensions, so d is 3. And if you want to discretize this thing by also about 10 points, which is also pretty modest, then you already have here 10 to the fourth degrees of freedom. But we really want to deal with density matrices, which are like psi star psi. So you have to square this. 100 million functions. If you try to do this in more realistic circumstances, like, for example, in heavy ion collisions where we have tens of thousands of pions, so you in order to describe that information on the microscopic scale, you certainly have to have of the order of tens of thousands of field points, much bigger dynamic range in the volume. You see this grows very quickly and is totally out of control. So that's clearly not the way to do it. It'd be nice if you could do it, even if you knew the initial conditions, but of course we don't even know those very precisely. Now, I'm talking about recoupling. So your second idea might be, well, if it's recoupling, why can't we do perturbation theory? Right? That's what perturbation theory is designed for. Well, that doesn't work either, because because perturbation theory is good for Q-body scattering processes. So if you want to calculate the cross-section, that's the typical thing, or decay rate, then you write down some Feynman diagram, matrix element, and you square it. So this is basically talking about few and infrequent infrequent collisions. However, it doesn't take much thought to realize that to get to this limit, what we really want to discuss are a large number of frequent collisions, at least on the time scale. If we're going to look at very long time scales, then there's some collision time in the problem, and we want to look at times which are much larger than that collision time. So over that time scale, there will be many collisions, and therefore you really have to do something non-trivial with perturbation theory. A few diagrams isn't going to work. So Hydro requires many or frequent collisions. Otherwise, there's no possible way to get to a near thermal equilibrium state locally. Now, of course, you can often cheat here, and this cheat goes way back even to the perfect gas equation of state. Namely, if you assume thermal equilibrium, don't ask about where it came from, then of course you don't need to maintain it. You've built it in, and you get an equation of state, and you can start with hydrodynamics, as what usually is done. And if you take a perfect fluid equation of state or some simple equation of state, then you can, of course, just evolve the equations of hydrodynamics forward. But that leaves completely untouched the question of how that local thermal equilibrium state was established. And you start to see the limitations as soon as you push the system slightly out of equilibrium and want to understand how it's going to relax. And for example, just in linear response, when you look at transport coefficients, you already see that you cannot rely on just the equilibrium equation of state. Okay. So, since Uli is sitting right here, the expert, I should mention that in the program which we've had over the last few months, now in the final week, one of the main topics of discussion has been the great success and yet remaining questions of hydrodynamics in the quark-gluon plasma. And just a statement of connecting this very broad topic to experiments, the experiments seem to fit reasonably well with a hydro description, but they require a rather short thermalization time. Just for folks outside the program.
These are heavy ion collisions?
Yes. Yeah. In heavy ion collisions, you start with two big heavy nuclei, like lead on lead or gold on gold. You slam them into each other, and then you try to describe the properties of the final state in terms of some evolution of the from initial data. And of course, the initial data is not completely known, because you'd have to know the exactly the wave functions of the initial state. But if you assume thermalization in a hydro code and basically use the fact that, for example, the free energy or the pressure in QCD is known from the lattice, to have a sharp crossover at some TC, which is of the order of 165 to 170 MeV, then basically this growth is due to the large number of degrees of freedom of quarks and gluons. So there are, just because you have SU3, adjoint representation, lots of quarks, you have lots of degrees of freedom here. So at very high temperatures, this approaches very slowly, it turns out, an ideal gas equation of state, just given by those total number of degrees of freedom. And around this temperature, there is a very sharp turn on. And just because there are a lot more degrees of freedom in the quark-gluon plasma than there are in the hadron gas. And this is responsible for a larger pressure if you reach this temperature. And this is the main experimental signature of the production of this quark-gluon plasma, because if you assume this, then you have a large pressure, a large collective flow measured in this V2 parameter. And this seems to work pretty well, but there's a free parameter in the hydro code, which is when you start it, when you assume that you can go back and start at this equation of state. And that's pushed rather early back to 0.6 Fermi over C, which is quite a bit smaller than expected, much smaller, I would say.
And you might want to set that thermalization time is universal for the RICA and SPS, or if it's different.
Well, I think there is not much evidence for this collective flow in the SPS images.
Well, there is evidence for collective flow, but it's not, it doesn't seem to be ideal in the sense that you get only about half of the elliptic flow signal that you would predict from ideal dynamics, whereas I think you get the full signal.
Okay.
This is a blackboard lunch, right? So
yes.
You get to ask stupid questions.
You get to ask all questions, no.
So when you say you calculate these things hydrodynamically, is it a classical calculation where you just take two blobs of stuff coming together?
No. This is after the blobs have already collided and produced a lot of particles, then you assume that you've reached hydrodynamic equilibrium, local thermodynamic equilibrium, quite rapidly, say 0.6 Fermi over C, and then let the thing expand. The fireball, of course, is expanding into vacuum, and then just follow that bulk flow out, and then try to calculate various things like the expected PT distribution of pions and other particles.
But the equations you're solving are the Navier-Stokes equations?
No,
Euler equations,
ideal, no viscosity.
There's no viscosity in this?
No viscosity, ideal.
What is
that? That's a good question.
Can I say a few words?
Yeah, please.
Relativistic hydrodynamics with viscosity is an unsolved numerical problem.
Oh,
so you first start without viscosity, you find that it works, and then you start thinking about why it works.
So the claim is it works.
It works for something.
Politely, for the benefit of those not
right.
in the field, this is a fit.
Yes.
You assume given initial conditions. You don't know where the
conditions
came from. You have some initial temperature which is made up. You fit the data
for zero impact parameter conditions, and then you predict
it's
everything that
it's
you.
But you said
you fit the parameter
other
for zero impact parameter predictions,
okay.
And the statement that we are making comes from the fact that the non-zero impact parameter predictions are then entirely and correctly predicted. No further parameters. That's
so
what they say.
Does the fit include the HDP?
Sorry? What you fit is the initial energy density, the time when you start the hydrodynamics, and the temperature as the system freezes out. And that you fit to pion and proton spectra at micro rapidity in central conditions, in zero impact parameter.
Okay.
have a question. Do you have an estimate of some dimensionless number that tells you how okay it is to ignore viscosity?
I think I defer that question to you.
I mean, even roughly, you have some low estimate of viscosity.
I can't tell you in terms of the viscosity. Because we have no control, no calculations with non-zero viscosity. The only thing I can tell you is that if you increase that time by a factor of two, you miss about 20% of the signal that is the experiment.
One of the things that I want to talk about is calculating or at least estimating things like viscosity coefficients. So in a weak coupling approximation, which may not be valid in the actual experimental circumstance, at least one has some parametric control of the viscosity and therefore the time scales, but they are not yet in the numerical simulation.
I do wish to make another point that there are other fits to the data that don't make any reference to temperature or hydrodynamics.
Fair.
Now, I don't necessarily believe those fits, but these are fits that assume you have a saturation initial condition that then evolves essentially. Look, you may not like those fits. Your fit describes some features of the data. Their fit describes other features.
But they haven't fitted me too.
Yeah, look, I think it's fair to say that it's simply for the benefit of other people in the field. No, they don't fit V2, absolutely. I'm simply bringing.
I think you can all see why this has been an active and lively workshop. But your point's well taken.
Understood.
Yeah.
That the field agrees that you have created a thermal state,
fair,
that there are dimensionless numbers, say a row of dimensionless numbers, that I can precisely characterize, do I or do I not achieve thermal equilibrium. You have a detailed fit assuming a very precise equation of state, an ideal equation of state. That's an assumption. Why it should work in PC?
As a person who is not a practitioner, I would say that it looks to me like there's good heuristic evidence anyway for collective flow. Now, whether I would want to stay more precisely quantitatively than that, I'll let you guys.
And there's a lot of features that seem very interesting in terms of thermal. But
let's have some comment or questions from the others.
Okay, so this is a non-expert question.
Right.
In the theory of ordinary gases, there would be a middle ground between a flow and body description, which is, you say, you have too many degrees of freedom for, and a hydrodynamic system.
Right.
And that's
kinetic theory. Right.
So solving something like the Lassalle equation. So,
or Boltzmann with collisions.
Yes. So where does that sit?
That sits, roughly speaking, somewhere in between here. No, I mean, this is the part of the point of my talk, is to put all of these things in some logical order, if not necessarily temporal order, in the experimental situation at least, to say how you can go from quantum field theory to Boltzmann's equation to hydrodynamics. So definitely kinetic theory is usually thought of as the midway or halfway point between.
And it does have features which are not accessible to hydrodynamic description.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just about to talk about separation of time scales.
Can I just throw my two cents in? There
Sure.
are three things which have never been brought together, which is HPT, V2, and spectral
True.
And I think on the theory side, the Mickey Mouse models, which don't account for the quantum interactions, in the equations of state, don't account for the viscosity, cannot be taken seriously. And one has to really, at this point, simply this is, as Uli said up front, it's an exercise to see what is missing in the end, rather than when it works.
Sorry, for the non-experts, what's V2?
Okay, that'll take. That's basically looking in the transverse plane. These things collide collinearly, essentially. Then you look at the transverse plane and look at the transverse azimuthal distribution of particles.
Right.
And
I explained that 3 Mondays ago. So presumably you weren't there, but don't force them to do it in detail because if it was done,
I'm just curious. Is this specific experimental signatures you're talking about, or
the idea is that the azimuthal distribution tells you something about the pressure effects which push the plasma apart, and therefore are some measure of this collectivity rather than just single body scattering. But that's the idea in a nutshell. Okay, so good. So there's a lot of good questions, and obviously I can't answer them all. And let me try to go on here, because what I want to talk about is basically a sequence in which you can, at least conceptually, go from this left side to this right side of this dividing line, and all of the issues of how to compare these things arise. So the key assumption, of course, is going to be the separation of timescales. Now, if you have no separation of timescales, if all scales on length and time are equivalent, then you're not going to be able to make this connection, but then some completely different set of approximations are relevant, such as scale invariance, such as at second order phase transitions, or turbulence. But that's not what we're going to talk about here. We're going to assume that we have a separation of time scale. So first of all, let's just do some naive estimates. I want to calculate a collision time. If we're in a weakly coupled theory, we ought to be able to calculate that with just the pure collision time by looking at the matrix element for scattering and calculating that cross-section. So that's roughly the number density of particles times the cross-section for their interaction, times some velocity, but I'm going to be in a relativistic limit, so that's essentially the speed of light. So if you just put in some estimates here, basically the scattering diagram is the matrix element squared is going to give you something which is proportional to alpha squared. When you put in the dimensions right to get a cross-section at very high temperatures anyway, let's make the assumption that the masses are small and we're talking about just thermal excitations, then that just dimensionally has to go like over t squared. So this is t cubed for a relativistic gas times alpha squared over t squared. So you're basically talking about a time which is of order alpha squared over t. And we want to go to times which are much larger than that in order to get to the hydro limit. So if alpha is small, of course that's the big assumption here, then this time scale is much longer than the microscopic time scales in the problem, which are basically of order 1 over t. And that's what allows you to make some approximations. Another interesting time scale is the plasma oscillation time. So you know from classical plasma physics that there's a Debye frequency, which is basically the number density times e squared, or we'll call it alpha, divided by the mass of a particle. The non-relativistic case, for relativistic, this mass is going to be replaced by the temperature. So this is t squared times alpha. So you have a time scale, a Debye time scale, which is 1 over square root of alpha t. So again, if temperature is the only dimensionful scale in the problem, everything has to be controlled by just powers of alpha. If alpha is small, then you see you're going to start to get this hierarchy of scales in which this time scale is much longer than the collision time scale. Another way to think about all this is...
Shorter than the collision time.
Shorter, excuse me. Another way to think about this is, in plasma physics, they introduced the concept of a discreteness parameter. Which basically tells you something about the discreteness or non-sensitivity to the discreteness of the fundamental scatterings. So, for example, if you were to rescale, let me write this temporarily again as e squared, if you were to rescale the charge, just think about breaking the charge down into units, n big, and the mass likewise, but then the number density has to go up. because there are more particles. So you see that this particular combination is independent of n. Just put in the powers here. And so this is not sensitive to the discreteness of the system. This is some collective or mean field effect. In contrast, if you do the same exercise here, you will find that this is sensitive to the discreteness parameter. Now, when we go, this is for a non-relativistic theory, but if you go to the relativistic theory, the better way to think about it is what's called the large N or 1 over NF expansion. F stands for flavors. It just means the number of, if you replicate the number of charge fields NF times, then you see you can go through the same exercise here, and the number density scales like the number of flavors, of course, if I have N copies of the electron or fermions, whereas the electric charge scales like 1 over NF. And once again, I find that this combination of the bifrequency is independent of NF, so it should be there in the continuum, in the limit in which I take the discreteness of the charge carriers to zero, whereas this thing is proportional to NF. So in other words, if I took the number of flavors going to infinity, this thing would remain finite, but this collision time would be pushed off to infinity. And in a leading order large N approximation, mean field approximation, which I'll describe in a minute, this thing is pushed off to infinity, so I can't describe the physics of the collisions in the leading order approximation. I need to go beyond leading order. So let me talk a bit about the leading order approximation. Leading order in an expansion in 1 over NF, so it's going to be 1 over NF to the 0, it's also called, in many other contexts, either mean field or Hartree approximation. And there's been a lot of work on this over the last few years, 10 years actually, some of it by me and my collaborators, other people in the audience. The basic upshot is that you already take one little step in the direction from here to there. Certainly you're not there yet, but basically you can carry things up for timescales which are much shorter in this collision timescale, because you're not going to see that in the leading order approximation. And however, you already see, so let me write down an example. QED, electrodynamics. So the leading order approximation consists of these equations. The Maxwell equations, in which the electromagnetic field is coupled to the mean value of a current. And this thing goes like, it's basically a one loop diagram. So basically, there are NF flavors of this charge field going around. Then there's an overall factor V squared, but there's a factor of NF for the number of flavors. And with this rescaling, this is the leading order diagram. And you write this thing as essentially equal to the trace of some Green's function. And the Green's function itself satisfies an equation of motion like this. So this is the leading order approximation. It's self-consistent. You see, what's happened is I've written down a closed set of equations for the Green's function and the mean field. The mean field responds to the particles through their mean current, and their current is determined by their flow in the mean field. but there are no collisions because the particles are basically subject to this force, which is coming from the potential, but they don't directly collide with each other. And there have been, so let me show you, well, I don't have a projector set up, but basically the typical types of evolutions which you see, this happens to be a scalar field, doesn't matter, I won't go through the details for lack of time, but the point is that you see effective, and I have to be very careful what I mean by this, effective dissipation in the sense that you have phase averaging. This is basically equivalent to looking at a collisionless Boltzmann equation, a collisionless Vlasov equation. So you can think of the phase averaging as what's going on is in the quantum treatment, in leading order, this Green's function, of course, has lots of phase information about the electrons which are moving in this electric field. However, when you calculate a mean current, you're integrating over phase space, and all of those different phases tend to cancel out in such a way that if you look at the large volume limit and have basically no mass thresholds in the problem, in this case we have a mass, we also looked at scalar field case by four, in which you have spontaneously broken symmetry, so a second order phase transition, there are equations that are similar to this. And again, the statement is that if you have massless degrees of freedom, you have a threshold.
Enhanced Brownian.
Okay, so there is effective dephasing, and that's the kind of graph you get if you just run these things numerically. Let's go.
Yes. Is there a formal analogy between deriving the Vlasov equation from the BBGKY hierarchy in kinetic theory and the kind of procedure that
yes,
you just described?
Absolutely.
I don't need to say it.
There is. This is the first term basically in the Schwinger-Dyson hierarchy in field theory, where you have the mean values of the field coupled to some two-point function of the quantum field, which is a single body operator. In the language of many body theory.
Emil, the total energy of the mean field plus the charged particles is
conserved. So this is already, now here why I put this in quotes, because in fact it was shown, we showed in these cases, that this system, those equations are in fact still Hamiltonian.
Sure.
They're still time reversible. They're still non-dissipative in principle. In fact, it's a good way to check your code to change all the signs of the momenta when you're way out here, and you can go way out here and run it backwards, and it, sure enough, it reproduces the initial state up to rounding errors in the numerics. So what's happening, of course, is nothing else that energy is flowing from some mean fields to the particle degrees of freedom, and if you had a finite box, so you can already see some of these interesting fundamental issues at this leading order approximation. If you had a finite box, you'd have a finite, though denumerably large, number of degrees of freedom. You know, someone named Poincaré assures you there has to be recurrences, because it's a Hamiltonian system. However, that recurrence time can be pushed farther and farther away if you make the volume of the box bigger and bigger. If the number of degrees of freedom becomes basically the continuum limit, and the number of degrees of freedom at very small masses are the relevant consideration here, then that recurrence time is pushed out farther and farther and farther, and in fact, you never see it if you do numerical simulations. That's why you have effective dissipation. It's not truly an irreversible system, but you already see how truncation of the hierarchy can lead to some interesting dynamical effects. And this can be made more precise. Basically, the number operator, if you expand this Green's function in a number basis, then the number operator is essentially an adiabatic invariant of this Hamiltonian, whereas the phase, which is conjugate to the number, is very rapidly varying. So if you just, by hand, average over the phase, you then get what looks like a Boltzmann equation with no collisions for the particles. So you get an equation which looks like this. You could put in an x dependence if you wanted to.
And that's not reversible anymore.
So if you considered a different system, which is not identical to the system I've just written down, but which is closely related to it, namely in which I look at the first order differential operator of collisionless Boltzmann, so the zero means that I have no collisions, this is just the flow term, Vlasov. If I then compare that simulation, in which the number is plugged back into the mean field, it actually looks very much like the simulation with the with all the quantum phase information in principle kept track of. But this is irreversible, and this is reversible.
Not, well, what did you show? It's irreversible. It's entropy conserving.
Yeah. It's entropy conserving. That's true.
So you still have no approach towards Newtonian by solving the collisionless level.
That's right.
So I'm not quite sure what you mean by effective dissipation.
Well, here's what I mean, that certain observables relax to their equilibrium values. Not all observables. Okay. Certain mean field observables do relax, whereas the number density does not relax.
So essentially you have equal partition, but you don't lose the phase information.
Yeah. The phase, as I said, if you solve this equation directly, the phase information is all there. You actually run it backwards.
That bottom equation, though, you couldn't do your exercise of running the backwards. The bottom one.
Yeah, that's not a Hamiltonian equation.
Well, not true. And the system of plus Maxwell is Hamiltonian.
No, it's not Hamiltonian. There's an energy, but there's no.
Yes, it is Hamiltonian. It is Hamiltonian. I can show you Hamiltonian. Even if they're not really in case, I don't want Hamiltonian for that. You can use n and the gate.
Time derivative of n is a conjugate momentum.
Well, the Poisson brackets are non-trivial.
Exactly.
Right.
That's why it's not Hamiltonian.
But there are Poisson brackets.
Okay.
I don't see why you say it's not Hamiltonian, because if you're talking about the distribution function, f of x and p.
Yes.
Yeah.
What about it? I mean, there's no canonical Hamiltonian in
right.
which I can
no,
introduce Poisson brackets
sure.
and conjugate
no
momentum.
Yeah,
to
there,
it.
There's no canonical momentum associated
right.
with the particle
right.
distribution.
But there's a conserved energy.
And you can associate with Poisson brackets.
Okay, there's a bracket structure you can introduce. Okay, fine.
So you get some equilibration time scales here from these calculations?
No, what you see here is because this is leading order in large N, you basically see those oscillations are essentially the collective plasmon oscillations. And you also see the decay into massless modes. If you look at that 5/4 interaction, then basically in large N, you have an effective potential, which looks like this Mexican hat, where there's a large number, NF minus 1, of massless particles. So basically, as the system oscillates, it can create massless particles with arbitrary.
A true equilibration is associated with that top time scale, and that you won't see.
This is equilibration in the particle number, which of course you're not going to see
right.
where there's no collisions. But what's happened is this has been formally pushed out to infinity. Okay. Any other question? Okay. So I can make a remark about classical theory, because that has come up in our workshop also. Classical is basically corresponding to just solving classical equations without consistent coupling to the fluctuations or the number. And that basically only works if the number density is very large. If you have an effective number density in phase space, which is larger than about 1 over alpha, then you can employ classical approximations, but that's contained in this semi-classical approach. So in the initial states of a heavy ion collision, one of the suggestions that we've discussed a lot over the last few months is that you have some classical solid glass, it's called, All this means is that in the initial state, at very low momentum, there are basically a large number of affected gluons by looking at the distribution functions of gluons from other data like deep inelastic. And therefore, it looks reasonable, to some people anyway, to assume that you can make some classical approximation in some part of the distribution called the saturation region, and that's an effective classical approximation to the dynamics, which is certainly not valid over the whole range and for all times, but it's one idea on how to get going with initial conditions.
And they claim even the final conditions.
Yeah.
And some. So other fits, which Ulmi doesn't like.
Right. For the non-expert,
which also fits
one of the confusing and controversial things is that you can start with apparently very different pictures, one in which you have this completely coherent classical field, and you know that's only valid, if at all, for very small range of phase space and initial data, and you just march it through anyway to late times, and you then try to compare with experiments, and it doesn't do too badly for some things, at least it's claimed.
Well, but it doesn't do too badly for multiplicity.
Right.
It does pretty badly for a lot of other.
Right. So now that's very different than the hydrodynamic approach, and they clearly can't both be right.
Let me make a comment here, because we keep making this comment.
The fact diversity within the field.
The fact that in the data one sees anisotropic momentum distributions for anisotropic initial conditions is a unique proof of strong interactions among the produced particles. You cannot get it without reinteractions.
I agree, and
that means that any model or whatever that produces data and assumes zero interactions between the initial state and the final state is excluded. So any fit with a model of that sort, you shouldn't.
Something went on. Yeah. Something happened. I'll agree with that.
Well, I thought nobody could reproduce high PTV2, including hydro. That's open question, isn't it?
Or HPK for hydro.
I don't think it's fair to apply that hydro is working.
Hydro is a collective model, and it's not supposed to produce particles in the high PT tail, which are never collective. It's supposed to get the bulk of the physics, which is what happens below 2 GeV, and that it does.
I don't think classical is meant to reproduce high PT stuff like it.
Then I don't care.
I'm delighted by all this. I can sit down and let you argue. But.
When did it become the classical color glass condensate? Where did the classical come from?
Isn't it classical? Classical field evolution?
What he means by that is the acceptance of Allen's and then so on. They start with strong classical color field,
yeah.
And which could have existed classically.
Yeah, Rob, if we're going to talk about nomenclature, I'm actually much happier with classical than with condensate.
It's good to be discussing the physics, but if we're going to discuss words, then I really sit down.
The reason why I object to classical is because they assume that if fields are A 1 over G, that field strengths F squareds are 1 over alpha. And there are many examples where that's false because you have distance scales that enter the problem. It's not true for an instant time because they come in all scale sizes. So that's the example for the future. But you just showed us there's many time scales in this plasma. And in the evolution of the colored glass, whatever else it may be, they never take this into account. I mean, they
never
have
take what into account?
The fact that you have these other time scales. They assume if a field, A1 over G, is F squared 1 over G squared.
We're going to lose that.
We're losing our audience. So.
I have to provide true advertising.
Okay.
That's fine. But that.
So I'm not. I'm clearly not going to get to, the bulk of what I wanted to say, which is how we do these calculations of transport coefficients. But that's okay.
Please give us an idea. I mean, we came to hear you talk about.
Right.
I understand there are controversies in the field, but.
Right. No. You see, it's very good to give a theoretical talk where you have an arbitrarily weak coupling. And you have a real separation of scales, and you can really do some calculations. That's what I wanted to talk about. But on the other hand, this is a workshop on QCD and RIC, and so it's good to bear in mind the connection to the data. As soon as you get there, things get hard. And that's why we have controversies, because it's really not so obvious what the separation of scales is. That's the real underlying physics. Okay, so the main point is, the main message of the semi-classical leading order is that we're already getting some indications, not true dissipation, but we have dephasing, Landau damping, for those who know what that is, and some indication of approach of at least some quantities to what they should be in equilibrium, but of course, not the particle number, and for that we need collisions. So one approach, which Larry Affey and co-workers have been pushing, is to go directly to a kinetic theory with collisions, with a collision term. So in terms of that equation I just erased, instead of having a just pure Vlasov term, you could write down basically a collision integral based on the simple two-body scattering matrix elements. Now, that's fine, I think, for some quantities and for calculating transport coefficients. I think it's probably okay. But on the other hand, it doesn't address some of the issues which I think are worth addressing, which is how the irreversibility comes in. Once you put a collision term in, you've lost reversibility. It's clear. You've written down, by hand, like Boltzmann did over 100 years ago, introduced essentially a randomization after the collision process, and therefore there's no microscopic reversibility. So that could be very well a good description phenomenologically, and indeed is a good bridge from getting to here to there, but it doesn't address the fundamental issue of this, where does this irreversibility come from?
I thought Larry was saying something stronger, which was that, you know, well, in the paper which we're promised to receive in about a month, he was going to show that this particular kinetic theory was the right effective theory.
That's the only thing. I mean, we know how to calculate all of these
positions. Yeah, so it didn't sound like...
He's going to make that statement.
It didn't sound like he was doing it by hand.
He's going to make that statement, if at all, only for certain quantities,
correct,
like transport coefficients.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, stress viscosity, not part viscosity, but all chemical laws.
But you cannot, for example, include mean fields in this.
Why?
Not easily.
Why? I mean, just Vlasov plus collision term is both mean fields and collision term.
For color fields?
Right.
There's still some issues about
that.
There
are many papers on that.
I know, we heard them here at Christine Emanuel. But I think that has not been derived as a...
It has been based on kind of separation of time scales you mentioned there. As soon as the coupling constant is small,
But you have to calculate gauge invariant quantities. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that has been done properly. But that's for the expert. So this is not, in any case, a uniform approximation in which you can go from the very short time scales to very long time scales.
No, I
don't agree with that either.
No, I don't.
Oh, good.
I
okay.
I think you're on the team, and then you all have shown how to derive, you know, theory.
I've mentioned Jean-Paul have certainly shown. I mean, you may want more, but this gives us all transport coefficients.
I want more.
But that's quite an accomplishment.
Well,
And you really need kinetic theory. That's clearly the most efficient way of doing
that's,
it.
I think that's
it's
the most
not summing diagram.
That's the most efficient way to calculate those quantities once you verify that the diagrams are strictly speaking smaller, that the corrections are smaller.
If you decoupling expansion, it's easy to say. I mean, it's straightforward. You can't believe it. There's no doubt about that.
It's very difficult, and that's one of the reasons why Larry's worked on this for a number of years, to really derive that. It's a hard problem. It is not...
You need LPM.
It's a hard problem. So what I wanted to talk about, and clearly I'm running out of time, is a field theory approach which allows us to do these things, and which is interesting to compare. And allows comparison with kinetic theory. So let me just try to sketch what the idea is in the time that before you all give up and run out on me. So the basic idea you already see from here is that we need to include 1 over nf of x. So another way to see it, you can think about it for electrical conductivity in QED as an example, is that you need to include the collision time has to enter the problem, of course, in a fundamental way, and you can just think about a naive estimate of the conductivity from very ancient considerations. If you calculate the current produced by an electric field, well, you would say that the charges are accelerated according to Newton's laws, right? There are non-relativistic particles. And then the key assumption, this was made by Drude back in 1900, is that you don't have constant acceleration, but you have continual collisions. So instead, you develop a mean velocity, which is this acceleration times the collision time. So of course, you've completely put in irreversibility right here by assuming that the mean velocity is constant rather than the mean acceleration. And then you can calculate the current by taking the number density times the charge times the mean velocity. And you see that this is proportional to the electric field. And the conductivity is of order, therefore, E squared. Number density over m times the collision time. So the whole point now is to estimate or calculate the collision time. The reason why we don't get that in leading order, of course, is because, as you just saw from those equations, there are no collisions. The collision time is going to infinity. So you can see the problem if you start calculating perturbatively. Again, it's weak coupling, so you ask, what happens if I just barge ahead and calculate things perturbatively? Well, what happens is either get zero or infinity. So in field theory, I should use a green Kubo formula, calculate the change in the current. This is linear response theory. And calculate the change of the current with respect to an external field. So I have to calculate this retarded polarization function. And if I try to calculate that in perturbation theory, this is just a current-current correlator. And if you just look at the leading order diagram, well, it turns out that the conductivity requires taking the Fourier transform of this and going to omega equal to zero. In fact, the DC conductivity can be written as essentially equal to the limit of omega going to zero of the Fourier transform of this object. Particular components of it can be decomposed into longitudinal and transverse. And if you take the limit, having set k equal to zero, divided by omega, this is DC conductivity up to the sign. And if you just do this in perturbation theory, what you find is at leading order, there simply is no contribution to this. If you look at the imaginary part of this object near omega equal to zero, just because of two-body phase space kinematics, it turns out to have no support there, no slope, and you just get zero. If you dress these lines with hard thermal loops, as Rob and Eric taught us to do, you will still not find any contribution at lowest order. So you have to start doing something else. So you start putting in radiative corrections. Well, then what happens is, at least at finite temperature, you're at infinity. And the reason is that basically if you just do leading order perturbation theory, these particles are still quasi-particles which are living for an infinite amount of time. So now, as soon as I allow this interaction, the three-body phase space is no longer zero at the origin, but it diverges because the particles are living for an infinite amount of time. They're basically on-shell particles. So you see that this is going to be not easily accessible in leading order perturbation theory. If you start putting higher corrections, in fact, the divergences grow worse and worse.
And that this is infinite, even assuming you've renormalized the theory?
Yeah, these are infrared divergences. Infrared and collinear divergences here have nothing to do with the ultraviolet properties of the theory. So the basic thing that you have to do is you need control of this collision time, which in the field theory is going to be something like an imaginary part, 1/(imaginary part) of the self-energy. That's the width. You see, if these particles are on shell, then you basically get products of delta functions. That's one way to understand the infinity. It just means that there are secular terms if you do this in real time, because the particles live forever. However, if in actuality, in the medium, they're going to have a finite width, more properly thought of as something like a Lorentzian in their spectral functions. And then this collision time is 1/(imaginary part) of the width, so you need to get the width into the problem. And the essential point is that this comes in the denominator, and that's why this is, even though it's weak coupling, and these are weakly interacting quasi-particles, in fact, it's non-perturbative because it has an inverse and non-trivial dependence on the coupling constant in this particular kinematic limit. So I'll cut the story short in order to end. The basic point is that you can do this, and it turns out that you need to write down the inverse Green's function of the fermions, including this width, including this self-energy diagram. But if you put that in with just the skeleton expansion, in which this is the full propagator script G, then the self-energy is entering the problem. And this automatically implies that you also have to have a vertex correction because charge conservation or the conservation transversality of this polarization tensor has to be maintained. So that's why this is also non-trivial in gauge theory. In many body theory from Kadnoff and Baim's book, you often learn that you can put in the self-energy and not worry too much about the vertex, because typically we're not worried in the non-relativistic many-body theory about this kind of exact gauge invariance. But in our case, in a gauge theory like QED, you have to worry about that, and that generates a vertex, a non-trivial vertex, which I'll just write down graphically what it is. So of course, that's describing the collisions. And basically, it's the free vertex satisfies an integral equation like this, where these are the full propagators, and this is the full vertex. So I won't bother to write down the formulas. That's the structure of the equations. And this is necessary so that the polarization tensor you construct, finally, is transverse. So you see you have a complicated series of steps. You first have to look at the photon propagator in the medium. You put that into the self-energy. You get an integral equation for the spectral function, essentially, of the fermions, which has a Lorentzian width built into it. Then you put that into this integral equation for the vertex. And you finally construct from that the polarization operator, which now is going to be skeleton diagrams is going to look like this, where this is the vertex and this is the full propagator. So it doesn't look terribly different at the naive level from the perturbative expansion. But of course, because of these resummations, this contains a lot of diagrams. So a typical diagram here, if I went back to the free propagator, is because of this iterated ladder one photon exchange, I have any number of exchanges like this, and I have any number of self-energy insertions on the side here, but I don't have anything in which there's a vertex correction going across this, or I don't have any cross ladders. So this is the kind of resummation which you have to do in order to extract something as simple as the conductivity in electrodynamics, and that's why, of course, Larry doesn't like, you know, to go through this work. But, you know, John showed us how to do this in scalar theory, and we've essentially carried through this program in the electrodynamic case. And one can really check that the diagrams which are neglected are really higher order in the coupling. Yes?
But even in GCD, one can actually prove that in the kinematic regime, which gives you the conductivity, I mean, soft external lines, yes, this diagram is precisely summed by the Boltzmann equation, including vertex corrections and certain inverse. That's why Boltzmann equation.
For this quantity, I agree.
Yeah.
So, what is the parameter? Controversy extension?
Well, basically, there are two parameters. One is the weak coupling. And the other is a density parameter. What's really controlling this, as this is known for a long time in non-relativistic many-body theory, that when you sum up these diagrams, you're essentially saying that the mean free time, or mean free path, is long compared to the interparticle separation. So that's everything is basically controlled by the weakness of the coupling. So this collision time is large compared to some
1/T,
which is the mean separation between the particles. The interaction is weak, so you can justify that a posteriori if you wish. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that in condensed matter applications, they don't always worry about exact gauge invariance. Is that because the violations of gauge invariance are down by V over C, or is it a conceptual error?
Well, I would hesitate to call it conceptual error. I mean, they're talking about, you know, typically just, as you know, for example, in things like BECs, they're just talking about interparticle interactions where there isn't any gauge invariance. It just isn't from the beginning.
I suppose they do. Suppose they're doing the electron gas where there really is.
Yeah, they're doing the electron gas.
Is it better? It's magnetic effects? They're down?
Yes. It's controlled by V over C magnetic effect. They're typically dealing with asymmetric plasmas. So you have a heavy component, the protons, and a light component, the electrons. And you can make further approximations that you can't make in this ultra-relativistic
moment. But they do compute letters, that's true.
I yes.
Mean, they do have vertex questions. They just evaluate the vertex question in approximation. They don't validate yes. Not the method validation.
I think, no, in the limit for this quantity, I think they do not violate any gauge invariance.
They don't, sure. They just neglect as much effect.
But look, this is more a historical, a personal statement. When I trying to learn this subject and went and looked in books like Katnoff and Bain, you don't find any discussion about vertex corrections. You're told, write down a self-energy, use that in a collision integral, and you're done. Okay. And conceptually...
Because it's more general, because you have letter diagrams even in scalar theory, where you have no gauge symmetry.
Right. Yeah. But you have to worry about that. So. You know, the gauge invariance teaches you is more constraining, so it teaches you what you cannot do. But when you don't have that gauge invariance, you still have to think carefully: am I summing up the right set of diagrams? Are these the right process? So physically, what this corresponds to, of course, is a large number of multiple scatterings, and you're looking at time scales in which you have to sum up over all these scatterings to get correctly the conductivity, even in leading order in the coupling constant. So another issue, but I won't go into any more detail here because this is a complicated problem. It would take a seminar in its own right. Yeah.
Can you go beyond the leading order?
No one has done that yet. No one has done that yet. That would require putting in higher order 1 over nf squared corrections, which would certainly introduce cross sliders, and nobody has even tried to do that.
Has someone done the leading order, or just leading in aug? So not even lead order in g, but
yeah,
leading
so
in
aug. Yeah, so I'll write, yeah, what is quoted?
That's both my equation.
Right.
What is, only
yes. Yeah, people are running, yes. Okay, I should summarize, thanks. So I'll just say what the kind of thing that comes out of this is that, and this has been quoted by Yaffe et al. In the leading log approximation. As it turns out there are logarithmic corrections just because you have a range of scales which enter into the decay rate. And so you get integrals like dp over p, or dq over q for these exchange momenta, and that's cut off in a lower limit by the Debye screening and cut off in the upper limit by the temperature itself. So this thing involves a logarithm of this range of scales. So as somebody said already, there is in the literature by Yaffe et al. A statement from the Boltzmann approach of what this leading log number is. This is the dimensions, and this is the dependence on the coupling. And they have also calculated, I believe, the next leading log contribution. But what would really be useful is if you could sum up these logarithms and get the full leading order in alpha correction. Larry is promising to do that through his Boltzmann approach. We can also do it with a lot more work. It's all contained in those equations, and it just the problem is that in order to analyze it, you can pull out this number essentially analytically by making a series of approximations. But in order to evaluate the full structure here, you have to treat those integrals much more carefully, and all the analytic approximations you might want to make you have to be done very carefully, or you'll lose these subleading terms. But they're all contained in this schematic approximation scheme. Okay, so this is the main message here. Is I think you know, when Larry and I talk, we're only talking about the same glass half empty or half full. I agree that to calculate these quantities, that the Boltzmann equation is undoubtedly the most efficient method once you've justified it. Okay, but I'm thinking of this much more broadly as just a test bed, a test calculation for doing, you know, general non-equilibrium calculations. You're not, if you try to do the calculation far from equilibrium, then you don't have this easy separation of time scale. But the expansion that one has written down here graphically should apply as well. So you could describe quite non-equilibrium physics this way, which includes collisions. That's what I'm really after. And so to calculate the conductivity or these transport coefficients is just a test to make sure one has really gotten control of the expansion. Another issue is how this is connected to the normalization group ideas at real time, because, as I said, there are certain secular terms that give rise to this infinite DC conductivity. If you look at lowest order diagrams, Boyanovsky and De Vega have emphasized that you may be able to sum up the leading secular divergences and therefore have a renormalization group resummation. And as far as I can tell, we've been looking at this now since the workshop started back in April when Dan was here. It looks like there is a resummation of this quantity which will give the same result as the Schwinger-Dyson resummation for the leading order log anyway. We've checked that. So that's still in progress with Boyanovsky and De Vega. I think that's another interesting issue, whether one can generalize renormalization group ideas to these real-time dynamic processes, which we're still sort of in the only the first steps of doing. All right. I was going to talk about viscosity coefficients and what's known about them, but I think I'll skip that and just say that at least in this one example, we have the first indication of how to make this connection. So transport coefficient is one well-defined calculable parameter of the hydrodynamic theory, which one can actually get out of the field theory, I would say reasonably from first principles. There are lots of questions raised by this about the systematics of the expansion, but at least it looks like it's possible to do it. And I think this is what's ultimately needed in the non-abelian case, which is a much harder problem, in order to have a uniform expansion that will enable us to get from these classical or semi-classical descriptions of the initial conditions out to the hydrodynamic flow at late times. And it's a daunting problem even in this weak coupling approximations. And of course, in the real world, all these timescales are not so well separated at all. But I think conceptually, one has to go through this. And the experiments, I think, are driving us to formulate the right conceptual framework to do problems like this and try to extract hydrodynamics from the underlying theory. I'm going to stop.